These are songs that came out of my heart and my ministry these 27 years. We own this song. This is ours. And you need to listen to the words because it sure fits what I've been preaching about the gang mentality of horizontal coercion, acceptance in the gang, whatever your name you put on your Christian gang. It isn't what God wants, it's what the members of the gang think you should do. And I don't remember the particular occasion. Probably it was about the same time I penned the little song, "It's Harder and Harder to Love Some Damn Preachers." About the same time this song came forth. Do it again. You may be seated.
Friends and family who think they are example of Christianity. For years they found my freedom and took my liberty. No more can they do to me, but Jesus set me free. I've had it. In the name of love, my spirit has been slain by good intention people within the reign of strength, who place themselves a judge with mercy out of view, and think they're on a list of good, whole, and double pimps. I've had it with friends and family who think they are examples of Christianity. For years they found my freedom and took my liberty. No more can they renew me, but Jesus set me free. I've had it. They told me, shave my beard, such evil I must shun, and stay away from places where normal folk have fun. Separate yourself now, and be a good church mouse, cause the flames of hell will hit you if you're in that movie house. I've had with friends and family who think they are examples of Christianity. For years they found my freedom after my liberty. No more can they who knew me, but Jesus set me free. I've had it. They paid me for my records, my boosters, and my cars. He was all that bled to do, and I got battles won. Then while I got delivered, I finally saw the light. The hell with man-made versions of what is wrong and right. I've had it with friends and family who think they are examples of Christianity. For years they found my freedom and took my liberty. No fortune made to do me, to me the 73. I've had it.
Okay? You have in your hands a handout today of the 14th verse, which I've just written on the board from New Testament Greek. The last two Sundays, we dealt with Romans 2:12, already on the board, Romans 2:13, already on the board, didn't want to write it again. So I had them erase this one, and this is where we are today, the 14th verse, second chapter. The handouts also included from the 26th translation Bible, and I have 100 of those on the way for our bookstore. For you that don't have them, there are some hard copy, 3-volume sets in the bookstore. But I have included the 14th verse from the 26th Translation Bible. This text, this verse, has produced a lot of theological fights, a lot of nonsense, a lot of confusion, because it bites into a lot of pet theological theories. But before I tear this apart, as a matter of interest, I'm going to read you something from the LA Times. They continually review books on religious subjects. And of course, editorially, they tend to pick the ones that convey a message they want conveyed. But there's something interesting in the book review section of the Saturday paper, July 13th, that's yesterday. Enchanting, it's a book review on A Place of Healing for the Soul, Patmos, by Peter France. Enchanting Greek Island Worked Its Magic for Conversion. Well, there's a certain amount of superiority, snideness in this reviewer that I think I'd like to skip over and just simply go down to the fourth paragraph. For as Augustine and his literary offspring have made clear, conversion entails more than adopting a new set of beliefs. It means taking on a new mind and a new heart. Metanoia. Just thought I'd read that. Glad that they're saying something right about conversion. You can read the review and read the book if you want. Secondarily, I think it's time to make an explanation of some things to people that are listening that don't have the benefit that you have as those who come to the cathedral regularly. And we talk about our Bible manuscripts and our Bible collection. And it really needs the 14-story tower next door, which we are obtaining, to make a dent in it. You think you've seen it all, but that's only a part of the collection and the some 55 stations of the book. But as I write the Greek on the board, I'm sure there are many out there say, how do you know that's the right translation? And they come off the wall with statements like, we don't have any manuscripts past the 4th or 5th century. Not true. Since the King James Bible was written, well over 5,000 manuscripts have been found. And there is a great debt that Bible students and scholars owe to Nettle and Allen, the two scholars who put together the Nettle-Allen Greek-English New Testament. Now, over the years, three different streams of New Testament Greek publishers begin to flow, one out of a Bible society and two other streams. Nettle-Allen moved to the forefront. This 27th edition shows no changes essentially in the text. The 26th edition has the text unchanged. All they've added is what they call the apparatus. And it takes, it's like learning a new language, even though they got a small codified section of the apparatus like this. It's too fine print to really pick it up, but I'll come in close so you can give it a try. You sort of carry this apparatus that lists on both sides in fine print all the manuscript sources, and there's a chapter in front where you know how to read the footnotes, which are fine and detailed at the bottom. And this is in Greek and English, Greek on one side, English on the other side. All you need to see is how fine that print is. And as you read through this, where there's the slightest difference, where there's the slightest difference in any one of the manuscripts numbering into the thousands back through the centuries, they footnote it and reference which manuscripts agree or which ones disagree. And we have for you Tischendorf, who discovered the Sinaiticus manuscript, it along with the Vaticanus, the oldest complete Bible in the world. He produced a King James Version in which he footnoted everywhere these three oldest Bibles deviate from the King James. And for example, on this verse, he has one footnote. The Greek that opens this verse, hoton, gar, ethne, or twin, ethne, ethnic we get from that, which meant any ethnic group other than Jew, usually translated Gentiles, and you have in your King James for when the Gentiles, and Tischendorf's Bible, which many of you have in front of you, that we reprinted, makes the correction, it should be translated, for when Gentiles, without the definite article. And that's because the definite article is not there in each of the three oldest manuscripts that exist in the world today. But thousands upon thousands of manuscripts have been uncovered since the King James. The King James was based upon 10th and 11th century manuscripts. None of the oldest Bibles that now exist were available. So I think I'm going to take you through a quick tour. If they mess it up back there, I'll probably run my car into the truck when I go out. But I'm going to have them feed, and listen closely to me, Alan, feed into the screen a little quick tour of the room of the book. It's old hat to you, but there are people across the world listening and watching that have never been there. Let it roll, and I'll talk as you let it roll. Downstairs, just one section of the Bible displays is the room of the book. You enter the room of the book because it's the basic foundation of all the Bibles that flow through the centuries thereafter. And immediately, I ask him to take the camera around to the right, which is the basis of all these Bible records, to the room of the Torah. We call it, it's a little room off the side of the room of the book, the room of the sacred Torah. These are Old Testament Torahs from scriptoriums in the kingdom of Yemen, Middle Europe, the Khazarite kingdom, 400 and 500 and 600 year old Torahs. Originals, some of them buried to keep from destruction for years and then coming forth. That's probably one of the greatest collections and most buried collections of original handwritten on parchment, sacred Torahs anywhere. This lets us go. Don't interrupt me because I'm in a hurry. This lets me go right to the sources of the original manuscripts. These Hebrew manuscripts were not the basis of the Bible that we have as the foundation, the oldest Bibles that I'll take you to right there. There are only three, the Vaticanus from the 4th century, the Sinaiticus from the 5th century, or the 4th century, and the Alexandrinus from the 5th century. Those three Bibles, the oldest in the world. Two of them are in the British Museum. One is in the Vatican Library, but they made very few because of the fragile nature of the vellum leaves. Very few copies for institutions and libraries. We're fortunate enough to have copies complete in that select list of the Alexandrinus, the Vaticanus, and the Sinaiticus, the three oldest complete Bibles in the world, which included the Septuagint, Greek translation of the Hebrew, and the then extant manuscripts in the Greek. The first book ever printed was the Gutenberg. There's one of 14 vellum leaves that exist in the world. To the right of it, one of 40-some, 42 at last count, one of 42 paper leaves that exist to the Gutenberg. In this central hexagon, we have the first Hebrew Bible ever printed with the vowel points. We have the one of a half a dozen copies of an original of the 10 articles that separated the Church of England from Rome, without which there never would have been a Bible. That gave the freedom. Rare editions of Luther, but the most important thing I wanted to focus on here is right there now in front of you, the first Greek Bible ever printed in the West, the Aldine. The first Greek Bible ever printed. Now, as I said, none. This was based upon 10th century manuscripts that came west from Constantinople. None of the three oldest were available. The Vatican wouldn't release it. The Alexandrinus, 5th century, was sent to the King of England, but after 1610, when the King James was translated, and that's a Luther there, and the Sinaiticus wasn't discovered till the mid-1800s. But in addition to these manuscripts, all of which post-date the production of the King James, papyri, digging in trash piles, they began to uncover papyri. This is the oldest manuscript in private hands. A palimpsest, this happens to be vellum, a palimpsest of Timothy, overwritten by a Coptic devotional later. Modern science lets you read it. I had a fight with the British Museum and the British government to get it out of the country. And this is one of the most amazing collections of papyri. And we have papyri now that go back to the first and second century of scriptural passages. And in this group, there's one in Corinthians going back to the second century. And there's the Chester Beatty papyri, which is all of Romans, is in the Chester Beatty papyri that we're teaching on, with just small sections that are marred. We have papyri now, P26, P46, they're all numbered, that take you clear back, as I said, to within a few decades of when they were first written. And I'll take you from this great collection of papyri that's in this room of the book, which is designed to say, this is the spring, diverse though it may be, from which the Bible grew, and through the centuries, we then trace to the American Bibles on four floors here in our collection. It's access. Every little scrap has been analyzed by the scholars. There's no book in the world ever been analyzed like the Bible records. Every word analyzed, every word in computers now, every inflection. And Nettle Allen, once you learn to use the apparatus, every word in the New Testament can be traced to which manuscripts agree with the King James, which manuscripts differ, which ones agree on what, to the degree that they now, like plotting a tree, they can tell when a certain branch of the church from Alexandria versus a certain branch of the church at Rome versus scriptoriums at Caesarea, the copyists, if they made an error, would begin to perpetuate the same error until you can follow. It's not necessarily the oldest that's accurate, because an error may have occurred. And the way they did this, one would recite and read, and another would listen and write, and another, the corrector, would check. And you have a symbol, for example, for the Sinaiticus that Tischendorf found. A was already taken, so he decided to use the Hebrew first letter of the alphabet. And now we will have symbols like 1 or 2 or C or D, depending upon clear up to the 4th century when it was found. They're able to isolate which corrector's hand went back and made a correction. They each have their own style of writing. No book has ever been analyzed. And as you read this, you'll be amazed. The little changes will be verses of thee being left out. In English, we have definite articles, thee, and we have indefinite articles, a and an. In the Greek, they don't have an indefinite article. If it has a definite article, you know it can never be indefinite. But not necessarily is the absence of a definite article, meaning there's no definite article to be added in the translation. So, in essence, you can say if there's a definite article, it can never be indefinite. If there's not a definite article, it usually is not definite, but may be. And then translators will argue whether, since it has in the context clearly the need of definiteness, and definiteness doesn't exhaust all the use of an article. That was the great contribution of the Greek language to all other languages, was their mastery of the article. But the context tells you it should have an article, and some copyist down the road will add one. 5,000 manuscripts will have less than 5% variation. No book in the world has had critical look like this one. And I have 2 Greek testaments. I told you last Sunday when I was writing that I have a Greek testament, rare to find, that has as a parallel the King James, because most of these Greek testaments have the English portion and the New International Version, which is the preferred by the scholars. The King James, like the Geneva for 400 years, is the popular one that everyone has, so I start with the King James. But I made a couple of corrections here, pointing out that if I were writing the Greek from one of my Greek testaments, I would have added those 2 definite articles. But that Greek Testament clearly says it is based upon Stephanus, the textus receptus, the text received for many years strictly accompanying the King James. Now, we have the copy back there of Stephanus, folio produced by Erasmus, in which he wrote the verses that now control the verses in every Bible, and you can see it in his own handwriting in that central station of the book, right behind the center aisle here back in the foyer. I know what Stephanus wrote. Stephanus took Erasmus' translation, which we just showed you, the first Greek Bible, done by Erasmus. And he then wrote the verses in with his own hand. That's the only copy in existence. But it's much improved, because that's 10th century manuscripts that Erasmus was using in the 1500s. And since the 1500s, as I've said, more than 5,000 manuscripts, and papyri became a science. So I know when I'm quoting my other Greek Testament, the only difference was two definite articles added. He's basing it on Stephanus. When I go to Nettle Allen, 27th edition, I know that it is the result of centuries, literally, looking at every manuscript, every papyri, every source, every lectionary, every verse in the Bible, in the New Testament, and most of the Bible has been preached on at some time by early church fathers, and they were reading a manuscript that they are quoting, as you're seeing me put my source manuscript on the board, and all these weighed together come up with a common text. So don't anybody come off the wall. They can't write their name in Greek. Some idiot out there who tries to say, well, you don't have any manuscripts you can be sure of. The hell I can't. I've spent my life collecting and reading and searching what actually was said by Paul, since he's the subject of the book, he is the writer of the book of Romans, and that's the subject of this series. And with that intro, if you were to look in this, or what I printed out to you, I'm giving you the Greek text, attested to by all the scholarship, for this 14th verse. But when? Now, we've already talked last Sunday about the previous verses that postulate in Paul's day an argument that was shocking to them. They had what we defined as a camp mentality, what the scholars call covenantal nomism, what I called gang mentality. The our gang syndrome. And what Paul is attacking is their complacency that membership in the camp, the Jews of his day, particularly the Pharisees, that membership in the camp, by virtue of being a member of that group, the initiation rite being circumcision, external marks of separation from the crowd, like the song that was sung earlier, Sabbath keeping, kosher food, laws for behavior within the camp, originally designed to relate them to God, degenerate into a presumptuous, well, I'm a member of the camp. I'm eternally secure because I'm here. And those that are outside, even though we're not perfect, those that are outside don't have a chance with God because we're His special chosen. We're the camp of God. We're the assembly of God. We're the church of Christ. We're the United Brethren. We're the Catholics. We're the Mormons. We're Jehovah's Witnesses. We're the Latter-day Saints. Well, you might be all of those things as a result of trusting God and responding to His love. But being a member of the group doesn't make you better than everybody else. Being a member of the group, I'm sorry to announce it to you, Paul is saying, doesn't guarantee that you make it in. Well, we're not perfect, but we're a member of the gang. We adhere to the gang philosophies. And as I said, Paul is talking. Boy, look at this one. Size of this one. Charles, R. H. Charles did a study, unrivaled for many years, of the Apocrypha and what's called the pseudo-epigrams, pseudo-epigrapha. These are books written after the Septuagint that translated the Old Testament into Greek between 300 and 100 A.D. was closed. And all of the Bibles from those three oldest that I showed you we have copies of, clear up to the 1800s when the Bible Societies of America and Britain took them out, had the Apocrypha. Books written from Malachi up to and including and through the Maccabean Rebellion that were taken as Scripture and were part of the Septuagint. Septuagint translated the Old Testament, but the Maccabean Rebellion and the history of that was written in Greek, and Greek was the popular language of the day. But in addition, they continued to produce, after the Septuagint was written and closed, further writings by rabbis and prophets to the Jew. These are called pseudo-epigrapha. One of them, very popular in Paul's day, that he was dealing with when he dealt with the Jews to whom he's addressing this argument, and I'm picking up off of it and trying to make it apply to today, because the same syndrome exists in any religious community, to identify the community as God's only group, and then take the next step of degeneration after you limit God to your group and you've brought God down to your size, then to presumptuously believe that you at your worst are better than all those outside the camp. Outside the pale, you haven't got a prayer. Inside the pale, God will never turn us loose. You can talk some living embodiments of sin in certain streams of the Baptist Church, Calvinistic, and they will look you in the eye and say that no matter what I do, I have eternal security. God will never let me go. No matter what I do. Inconsistent. I happen to think of one who looks like, well, he's one of those who have to buy three seats on an airplane. But he'll condemn you to hell if you take a glass of wine, which means he would rebuke Jesus. A moral reprobate that believes in eternal security will still say, God will never let me go. That's that gang mentality. That's what Paul was confronting. The Pharisees, the idea, I thank my God I'm not as that other man. And Jesus didn't jar him at all, saying, the publican who prayed, Lord, be merciful to me, a sinner, got his prayer heard. The Pharisee, with his robes gathered about him, I thank my God. Look at me, God. I'm yours. I think I'm not like that. Thank you that I'm not like that vermin over there. And we don't have in our Bible what, as I said a week ago, they fed their children, fed themselves in their synagogues and in their studies, their constant repetition, their constant studying of Scripture, which included in their studies such books as Second Baruch, the Syriac Apocalypse of Baruch is the only one we have extant. The Apocalypse of Baruch, which for the sake of convenience will be designated Second Baruch in this edition, is a composite work written in the latter half of the first century of the Christian era. Its authors were Orthodox Jews, and it is a good representative of the Judaism against which the Pauline dialectic was directed. Unless we can understand that the preacher of a large Baptist church is listened to more, and they spend more time listening to him in their once a week trip to the service than they do studying the Bible or listening to a teacher that's going to pull it apart as I'm doing. And as I said last Sunday or previously, we're more familiar with General Schwarzkopf and the heroes of the September 11th disaster than we are revolutionary heroes or Civil War heroes. It's just human nature to be more in tune with the events that are closer to us. And the Maccabean Rebellion and the delivery from Antiochus by the Maccabeans and the restoration of the temple, which is celebrated in Hanukkah, was more vital and real than remembering Hezekiah's victory over Sennacherib. The great victories that were solemnized in their feast days always stayed fresh. And yet, in our Bible, we don't have the basis for Hanukkah unless you include the Apocrypha. And in the Maccabees, in the Maccabean Rebellion, you have the Festival of Lights and Hanukkah springing forth as one of their feast days. But this is the kind of book that couched their thought more than reading the Old Testament. This is the kind of book that I'm going to just grab a passage out of, that these people that Paul's addressing, who have the camp mentality, that we, because we're members of the camp, we're all right. I'm okay. I'm here. I'm still in it. I'm still here. Doesn't matter what I'm doing or how vile I am. I'm still in the camp. And it's being a member of the camp that saves me. Being in law in the sense of in the pale, where law rules as defined by our mouthpieces, the Pharisees. And here's one of their texts. This is what Paul was fighting. This apocalypse, we have almost the last noble utterance of Judaism before it plunged into the dark and oppressive years that followed the destruction of Jerusalem. For ages after that epic, his people seem to be bereft of their gifts of song and eloquence and have energy only for the study and expansion of the traditions of the fathers. But when this book was written, that evil and barren era, the destruction of the temple and the dispersing of the Jews had not yet set in. Breathing thought and burning word had still their home in Palestine, and the hand of the Jewish artist was still master of its ancient cunning. This beautiful apocalypse were incorporated into the Syriac Bible and then was lost sight of for quite 1,200 years. Written originally in Hebrew, it was translated into Greek and from Greek into Syriac, and of the Hebrew original, every line has perished save a few surviving in rabbinic writings where they quote them. Of the Greek version, a small fragment has been recovered from the papyri, While many phrases and sentences have been preserved in the Greek Apocalypse of Baruch, and in the rest of the words of Baruch, happily the Syriac has come down to us in its entirety in a 6th century manuscript, the discovery of which is due to Syriani. Am I boring you? Of this manuscript, Syriani published a Latin translation in 1866, the Syriac text in 1871, and the photolithographic facsimile in 1883. The Apocalypse is, as has already been stated, composite. They are contemporaneous with the chief New Testament writings and furnish records of the Jewish doctrines and beliefs of that period, which is why I'm bringing this up. This is what the mindset was that Paul was writing to, and of the arguments which prevailed in Judaism in the latter half of the first century, with which its leaders sought to uphold its declining faith and confront the attacks of a growing and aggressive Christianity. Written by Pharisaic Jews as an apology for Judaism, and in part an implicit polemic against Christianity, it gained nevertheless a larger circulation among Christians than among Jews, and owed its very preservation to the scholarly cares of the church it assailed. But in the struggle for life, its secret animus against Christianity began an instinctive opposition in Christian circles, and so proved a bar to its popularity, thus the place it would naturally have filled in the Bible, in the Apocrypha, was taken by the sister work, 4th Ezra. So that's why it didn't get included in the Apocrypha, because it was a thinly veiled attack on the Christianity as presented by Paul. And we see in this Apocalypse of Baruch the frame of mind that Paul was attacking. But in the 51st chapter, I think it's the 51st, or 56th or 7th, 57th, they trapped themselves because Abraham's their father, and since the law is everything, they have to recognize something at God's hands, and Paul knows this, and he can seize on it, and that's my leap into this verse. How? Paul's going to argue in the 4th chapter, Abraham's works didn't get him in. It was his faith. But trying, like James in the New Testament, to argue with Paul and counteract the preaching of Paul, 57th chapter, 2nd Baruch, this Pharisaical polemic against Paul, giving the history of the world, after these waters thou didst see bright waters, this is the fount of Abraham. Also his generations and advent of his son and of his son's son and of those like them. Because at that time, the unwritten law was named amongst them. Bingo. They're having to face up to the fact that God can somehow plant a law not yet written in the heart of a man. And Paul, having suckered them into that, will later in the 4th chapter point out that, yes, he had the unwritten law in his heart. He still didn't keep it. He still was saved, not because of his works in keeping this unwritten law that they conceded and set themselves up for. He didn't even keep it. Only faith saved him. But that's a shoehole into what Paul is saying here to these who think having the law, hearing the law, being the possessors of the law, being the ones that receive the revelation of the law, not recognizing that hearers of the law will not be justified, but doers. Then having said that, he leaps into this 14th verse as further proof. For when Gentiles, ethne, this ta is very interesting. There's two of them here. It's a particle. And you'll notice as you look at the handout, a little difference between those two tongs. You looking at it? It's a determiner. See the D-N-N-P underneath it? Determiner, nominative, neuter, plural. And the second ta is determiner, accusative, neuter, plural. Now it looks the same. Looks the same in the Greek. But this is one of those connecting articles to where you normally would say, as I will say down here, where it is a definite article, but in the form where you normally add and assume things. The things. But I'll get to that in a moment. Up here, the ta has a different meaning. It identifies in a way that we don't do in the English. You don't have a definite article for a whole sentence or for a whole phrase normally. In the English, we say the word poor, and we also have a form of expression where we say the poor. And that brings conceptually into our mind a breed of people, a category. But normally we don't have a definite article for a whole phrase. That's what this nominative use here is doing. It's literally saying, you could translate it that or who, but better, the ones. So what we're saying here is, for when Gentiles, the ones, because it's a definite article for this word, and this word, which are adjectival, participial, to use complicated words, adjectival, participial expansions, like an adjective modifies a noun, the Gentiles are going to be modified as the ones, not law having. Not law having. For when Gentiles, the ones not law having. Now remember I told you, if you'll work through the grammar with me, then I can hammer it home. How many hated English? See? And God has rewarded you by making you have to study Greek. But it's worth it if we get the truth out of what Paul actually said. Now listen to me. For when Gentiles, the ones not law having, now later on, because I've read the whole verse, Paul is going to point out they have a law. And you remember I said, if there's a definite article, it cannot be indefinite. But if there's the absence of a definite article, it may be definite if the context requires it. Follow me? So definite article can never be indefinite. Indefinite, most of the time, is indefinite, but may be definite. Because Paul's going to point out, they have a law, then it's mutually contradictory to say they are the ones not having a law of any kind. So you have to put in, because of the context, they don't have the law, which flows from 12 and 13, because he's trying to prove that there are those outside the camp. Oh, they accept that Gentiles can get saved, using modern terminology. They were proselytes who proselyted Gentiles, but they had to go through the initiation rite and conform to all the rules of the camp. And if they sing the song, "I've had it," they're out. Because you can't have it. You can't criticize the king. God better not send his son unless that son's going to submit to their approval. Well, he fulfills the law that they don't, and his standard's higher. But this camp mentality is the camp that has the law. Now, Paul is saying, God's going to judge not the hearers in the camp. They hear the law more than anybody in the world. They memorize it. It's like the Arabic camps that train children in the Quran. Well, they know the Quran. They may not even be able to speak the language, but they memorize it and give speeches for long durations, having memorized the Quran. They're hearers of the law. No one studies the Torah like the Jew. In the same newspaper I read from, a Korean is studying, he's a Christian and a pastor, but he's studying with a Jewish rabbi to learn ways to keep the camp of the Korean Christians intact by the same study methods and procedures that the Jews do to keep their identity through the centuries. I'm not faulting it. I'm faulting the complex that reduces God and the chosen favorites as better than everybody else because they have membership in the camp. Indeed, this Korean pastor had to find a Jewish rabbi who was also a professor open to teaching others about Judaism before he could find someone that would even let him study, because he was outside the camp. It's in the same newspaper Saturday. You can read about it. Now, having said, we have the law, and that makes us the people of the law, and that makes us the people identified in the camp. That makes us our gang, and our gang is God's gang. No, no, no. At the judgment day, hearers of the law are not going to be any better than anybody else. You can hear the law, you die. You can recite the creed perfectly. Doers. And I've already covered the ground. God's still on record. You do the law perfectly, your whole life seamlessly. You're the next Jesus Christ, and he'll give you eternal life. And I offered a couple of weeks ago, you can sign up with the usher and say, "I don't want this faith business. I want to go by the works of the law." If you can do it perfectly, and if you've been doing it, and if there's not a spot or a wrinkle from birth to death, you can get eternal life that way. And at the judgment, it isn't going to be the hearers, the doers. Paul's adopting their premise right now. They say, doing the law, okay. Doing it and hearing it. Put your mouth in one place and your deeds in another. The mouth ain't going to work. The ears ain't going to work. The deeds, that's all that counts. And having said that, he's now going to show the heathen do better than they do. For when Gentiles, the ones not the law, for reasons just said, add the definite, having Fusai by nature. I mean, this is one of those words that you trace all the way back through all the Jewish and the Greek to Aristotle and to Plato and to all the early Greek writers. But at its root, it's what you are by nature. It's that which you don't seek to obtain or study to get. It's by nature. For when Gentiles, the ones not having the law by nature, the things genitive, and this is true when this is used and is followed by a genitive, that's your clue that it has the silent things written in. Go to your grammar books, you that are really pursuing it, and ta, as the form of the definite article, when it's immediately followed by the genitive case, origin or source case or possessive case, it has the silent things. So when Gentiles, the ones not having the law, by nature, the things genitive of the law, here's your definite article in the genitive too, of the law, practice, poiosin, I wrote it up here because it ran out here, poiosin, practice, or do. Now let's do that slowly. This is shocking to these people. Not so shocking to us because we're Gentiles, we formed our own camps. But in Paul's day, this was revolutionary. For when Gentiles, the ones not having the law, by nature, the things of the law do or practice, hutoi, these, law, and again, because he's talking about the same state of mind, so you've got to put the definite in. These, the law, not having, ekontes, these same ones, Gentiles, the ones the law not having, by nature, the things of the law do, these, the law not having ones, heautois, to themselves, eisen, are, a law. Now think about that. Let that settle in. You're saying to me, Paul, having argued that membership in the camp is not sufficient. I'm a Baptist, won't sell at the gate. I'm Assembly of God and always have been. My granddad and my grandmother were. It won't buy you an entrance. I'm Catholic. I'm Episcopal. I'm of the camp of nothing. I'm Church of Christ. That's what Paul dealt with at Corinth. Some say they're Apollos, some say they're Paul. Sorry to tell you this. I go to the cathedral. It won't get you in. The pass here is not a guarantee of the pass up there. You can be hearers of truth, doers. And here we're not doing works of the law. We're doing works of faith. Here it's not hearers of the law, it's the hearing of faith. That's 27 years been being taught. In this case, how shocking. I mean, you're telling us membership in the camp won't do it. And you're saying that just because I'm in the camp, the fact that I'm not perfect, I'll tell you this, if they were perfect in the camp, they'd make it because they're perfect, not because they're in the camp. But in the camp, a bit imperfectic, you know, imperfect. I mean, the thing I erased from the board, I'm not 100%, but I'm 80%. So that ought to get me in. It's like horseshoes. No. Hearers won't do it, doers only. For when Gentiles who don't have the law, by nature, the things of the law practice, these, not having law, to themselves are a law. How can that be? Well, now, that's next Sunday's message, and I'm not leaving right now yet, because I'm not done with this one, but that's next Sunday's message. What Paul is going to argue is what they argued about Abraham. That God has planted in human nature a compass. He's put inside human nature. Now Paul's going a step beyond the first chapter where you're condemned and God's wrath boils up because the obviousness of intelligent design, the obviousness of this vast creation screams out a creator. And it is a willful, not a first instinct, a willful rejection of a supreme power motivated by the independent desire to run my own life, to understand for myself, to be like God, from Satan to the motivation he gave to Eve. And God turns him over for the rebellious attitude of refusing to recognize his presence and be thankful. But now we're in the moral ground. And what Paul is leading up to, he's posing the question. Here are Gentiles not having the law that he's going to show will outperform, all he announces here is, are doing the things contained in the law. You don't have to think very far. Doesn't matter what the society. Even cannibals and tribal warfare frown upon murder within their gang. Honor of parents. Don't steal from members of your gang. As a gang, you steal from somebody else. But all that is modification of a deep-rooted compass. In other words, Paul's going to declare, man is without excuse and man is a failure by whatever standard. Man is going to put himself first, and gangness is attractive because it's somewhere between me and God. It elevates me as a member of the gang and enlarges my egocentric identity and reduces God down to my size, and now I am morally right to sin in the name of preserving my gang. That's why white-suited thieves cannot go public that they would be a friend to a cigar smoker. There's no Bible against cigar smoking, but there is Bible against stealing. And plagiarizing is stealing. Just thought I'd slip that in. You reduce God down to your ministry. Then you can sin in the name of your ministry because you've reduced God down to your gang, and whatever furthers your gang is furthering God's work because you've reduced him down to your gang and elevated yourself because man, part of that God put in man can't really live with himself, deifying himself. He has to find something a little larger than himself, deify it, and sin in the name of furthering that, be it family, tribe, church, gang. Well, I preach a one-on-one relationship with God. Don't ever confuse the fact that as the teacher and the rules of this house, I'm responsible, and I therefore take that authority and set and enforce the rules of this house, just like a teacher in any university. But don't ever think that I think that I'm in any position to rule your personal lives. I teach you, and you, vertically with God, have a right to work out your own salvation with Him. You come on staff with me. I make it very clear with no illusions. I don't play manipulative games. You are here to follow me as I follow Christ in executing my job. And as long as I take the heat and the responsibility, I author the decisions. I don't need a rescue effort from somebody. I don't need a savior coming in. I want somebody that will come. And it's so simple, but it proves our nature. Just do what you're told. But this generation can't do that. Can't do that. They got to knock home runs. Why, the coach has to be a Zen master now. You can't just tell him, look, you jerk. You dumb overpaid jerk. You don't get fired if we don't win. I do. But if you don't do what I tell you to do so we can win and I don't get fired, I'm firing you. But they can't do that anymore. You got to be a Zen master. You got to push books in their face. You got to figure out anything from Nietzsche to the Bible. Whatever works, you just use it. That's the modern coach. You got to be smarter than the dumbos you're herding around. And you got to just manipulate, deceive, con, do anything, use public announcements, do anything. Just herd them. Now, God's way. That's fine in the world. I don't know how to play. I'm playing football. Don't come at me and say, I'm a Christian now, and it looks like you're going to run to the right. And you can't tell a lie now. So you tell me, is that the way you're going to go, or are you trying to fool me? And that's not very Christian if you're trying to fool me. Now, I'm on the other side of the line. I want to know, tell me the truth. Are you going that way or this way? Because you look like you're going that way. Look, you vacant-headed idiot. We got in this. The integrity here is we're going to play by the rules of the game. So up yours. I ain't telling you which way we're going. You knew that when we got in here. I know how to play by the rules of the game. But this ain't a game. This is a life-transforming mission. And I'm the teacher. And you can do what you want with it. But what is being said here, declared by Paul, is God put a compass. He not only gave a marvelous creation that speaks of His creatorship, everybody, He put a compass in. Now, it may not say the same thing. There is no universal definition of sin and no universally agreed upon definition of what's right. But there is a universal sense of oughtness. Man is so constituted, he can't continue down any path without convincing himself that the path he's on is right. That's the haunting conscience that's implanted within. Now, the next verses are going to talk directly about conscience. And the Greek word is very enlightening on what we translate as conscience, which comes from Latin words, which means with knowledge. There is an implant, and these, not having the law, yet practice the very things that if the Jew practiced the law and did them, would be identical behavior, such as, I already named some, thou shalt not kill, and honesty. I don't know. They usually reduce the mores down to their camp. But I don't know any jungle village where the chief is revered because he lies. They want a chief. His word may be law. But in their heart of hearts, they want a chief they can admire and respect. I don't want any primitive society. I don't know cannibals or headhunters that eat their mother or behead their mother. I've studied anthropology from the pioneer works of Margaret Mead. I was going to do my PhD at Cal that gel together anthropology and geography before it went to Stanford. So I had to get ready for it. Primitive societies have mores. And they enforce them. The more modern they get, the looser they get. What Paul is saying, these that don't have the law and practice the very things of the law are proof that to and in themselves they are the law. And they will be judged by that law that they have. Now, I want you to see some subtleties of the Greek, why I love the language. There are two words, plus derivatives and changes with cases, for not. Or, ou and me. Ou and me. Ou, 99/99 millionths, always means not a chance, not ever, not. That's it. Not. Doesn't happen, can't happen, won't happen, never will happen. That's a cleaver coming down. That's a negative. That's final. Me is a softer negative. Me is very little possibility that it's not a not, a negative, but the door is open. It's not sealed and nailed down. Hickey Robertson once told the story of trying to distinguish in his Greek manual between ou and me, and used the homely illustration of proposing to a girl you want to marry. If she says, me, the softer form of not, then you may still have a chance. Go buy some more flowers and try again. But if she says, ooh, get your hat and leave. Now, I want you to notice, Paul is saying, in every case here, for when Gentiles, the ones, me, he doesn't say ooh or ook, other forms of it. He says me. For when Gentiles, the ones not having law, by nature, the law do, these, me again, not the law having. You see, Paul, as he goes through this chapter, is not going to be final in what happens to the Gentiles. All he's saying is they got some kind of law in them. God puts in everybody. So if you're going to start screaming innocence and people worry, well, now, I don't want to accept God's salvation because I don't think God's fair, because what about these heathen out here that haven't heard of Jesus? They're going to be judged by the law that's in them. They're not going to be judged by the same standard. But Paul even goes further. He doesn't use ooh in saying not the law. He's not willing to say absolutely they didn't have the law. Oh, they didn't have the Torah written. They didn't have. He's not even willing to say any of that. I mean, I still don't know. Well, one of my questions when I get to heaven is, where were those 7,000 that hadn't bowed their knee to Baal when Elijah thought he was alone, wanted to commit suicide because he was just alone? I want to know where those other sheep are that Jesus spoke of. Paul uses the softer not because he's not willing to say under his guidance of the Holy Spirit that they didn't have the law. But he is saying The high probability is they're without the law that defines the behavior of this camp. And as far as the Jews are concerned, they have the only law. So they don't have that, and yet they outperform the Jew. They do by nature. And part of that nature is an implant from God that feeds the conscience, as we'll say in the next two verses, as I get to it next Sunday. And they are that implant to them is the law by which they'll be judged. Now I have some bad news for you. After ruffling their feathers by suggesting that these are not the only, these tent meeting people are not the only people God has dealt with, and suggesting the possibility that God has somehow revealed himself with a minimal law that they will be judged by, and that they do some, that's why it's not the Gentiles, they don't all do it, but rather, as the Tischendorf copy corrects, rather indefinite, some Gentiles practice not all the law, but elements of the law, without having the law that the camp meeting crowd had, and yet they're doing the things that if they had been told of the law, are what the camp meeting crowd's rules say do, not all of them, because they have a law written in their hearts to interpolate. Well, now then, who needs the law? I'm just going to let my conscience be my guide. Sorry. He's moving on to Romans 3:10. Athos. Gegraptai. Hoti. For as has been written that, let me find a place to write it. Right up here. As has been written, ook. That sounds bad, ook. Ook. As has been written. This is oo with the K because it's followed by a vowel to make it easy to speak. Esten. For not there is righteous. Ikaios. For as has been written, that there is none, not a righteous man, a righteous one. Ude, this not again, in a compound. Ude, ice. Now, writing upside down, the ink doesn't come out. This is not with a K added because there's a vowel following it. There is not, indefinite, a, anywhere, a righteous one, ude, not even one. And you notice, having prepared you, he's not using me. He's not using the soft form of not that leaves open the possibility. By the time we get to the third chapter, quoting out of their own book, in this case Ecclesiastes, he's going to say, pathos as has been gegraptai, from which we get graph and graphy and graphite, as has been written, that, which is dropped usually in oral discourse, because that takes the place of the quotation marks, as has been written that, Esten, there is not a righteous one. Not even one. So he's going to lead them to this third chapter, and in a series of six or seven quotes out of the Old Testament, he's going to conclude, by your own law, the verdict is already in. Whether it's the law written in the heart of the Gentile, or the law written in the camp manual, works fall short. He'll go on to say, there's none that understand, none that doeth good. All have sinned and come short of the glory of God, and this is as good as a mile. All this is leading to the disastrous conclusion, whether I'm in the camp and hear the law from my youth up, or a Gentile that has this nagging pressure on me that proves that God has not abandoned anybody, and everybody gets a chance. They don't even live up to their limited implant. All have sinned and come short of the glory of God. But the Gentiles outperform by their conscience the Jews, and the workings of the conscience and the workings of the mind that all of us will look at and see as a mirror of our own daily behavior proves God has put inside all of us a standard that we argue with and continually betray, and first impressions are usually violated, as if you'll go back to the earlier verse, the spring of our motivation is self-centeredness, self-survival, and self-preservation, and we perversely make what we want to do look good and convince ourselves it's the right while rejecting the true good. And Paul will weave it through three or four verses as we go to it next Sunday to prove that these Gentiles outperform some of the Jews who have the camp meeting rules, but still fall short. Now, it's somewhat of a non sequitur, because it's more of a proof of the heritage in mankind of God's marks on all humanity, but it also proves the inability to live by the knowledge that's given even the heathen. Here's a little book, Eternity in Their Hearts. It quotes Ecclesiastes as I just wrote from 3:10, a quote from Ecclesiastes. This is the 11th verse. He has made everything beautiful in its time. He has also set eternity in the hearts of men. Yet they cannot fathom what God has done from the beginning to the end. Come on the cover, Machu Picchu. I still remember the staggering sight of going up the highway that had been built by the so-called discoverer of it, and marveling at this masterpiece of the Inca culture. Can I bore you?
Sure.
To show you, God has not left people without a witness, but they still violate it. Pachacuti, sometimes spelled Pachacutec, ruled as king of South America's incredible Inca civilization from A.D. 1438 to 1471, a little under a half a century before the King James was translated. According to Philip Ainsworth Means, late authority on Andean antiquities, it was Pachacuti who brought the Inca Empire to its finest flowering. What were some of his accomplishments? Well, he rebuilt Cusco, the Inca capital. I don't even really want the magnificent temple to the sun. He added a fabulous golden precinct. I don't need all of that. Most of you know that. But one such fortress, the majestic Machu Picchu, its existence was lost to the outside world. thick jungle overwhelmed the site. Then in 1904, an engineer named Franklin caught a glimpse of the ruins from a distant mountain. Franklin told Thomas Paine about the site. Paine, an English missionary, was serving under a society called Regions Beyond Missionary Union. In 1906, Paine climbed to the ruins with another missionary, Stuart McNairn. They stood in awe. Not until 1910 did Yale's Hiram Bingham, hearing of the discovery, visit Paine at Urco. Paine kindly outfitted Bingham with mules and guides for a journey to the site. Bingham thereafter made himself world famous as, quote, discoverer of Machu Picchu, lost city of the Incas. Bingham chose not to give a single byline of credit to Thomas Paine. There's no indication here that he wore a white suit, but mentioning only, quote, local rumor as the factor which guided him. Medical doctor Daniel Hayden, who knew Thomas Paine personally over a period of years in Peru, affirms that Paine, a humble man, beloved by Inca descendants throughout Peru, chose not to try to correct Hiram Bingham's oversight. See, he's a better Christian than I am. Thomas Paine remains just one of the innumerable Christian missionaries whose contributions to science have been denied recognition by men of science. Millions of tourists have visited Machu Picchu since Peru's new Hiram Bingham Highway made it accessible in 1948, and that's the highway I drove up. Almost everyone who knows anything about Incas know that they deified Inti, the sun. Yet in 1575 in Cuzco, a Spanish priest named Cristobal de Molina collected a number of Inca hymns and certain traditions associated with them, which proved that the deity of Inti was not always left unquestioned by Incas themselves. De Molina wrote the hymns and their associated traditions in the Inca language called Quechua, with orthography adapted from Spanish. The Incas themselves had no writing system. That entire collection of traditions and hymns traced back to the reign of Pachacuti. Modern scholars, rediscovering De Molina's collection, marveled at their revolutionary content. Some at first refused to believe they were genuinely Inca. Surely, they thought, De Molina himself must have edited his own European thought into the original Inca composition. Alfred Mitro, however, in his History of the Incas, agrees with Professor John H. Rowe, who he says has succeeded in restoring the hymns to their original version and is convinced that they owe nothing to the missionary teaching. The forms and expressions used are basically different from those of the Christian liturgy in the Inca tongue. Further confirmation of the authenticity of De Molina's compilation has surfaced, till another hymn of the same genre, Metro says, was, quote, miraculously preserved by Yamki Salcamaya Maigua Pachacuti in the 17th century Indian chronicler. One is only to compare this other hymn with those collected by Molina in 1575 to realize they all belong to the same literary and religious traditions. What was so revolutionary about the hymns? The traditions discovered with them state bluntly that Pachacuti, the king, so committed to sun worship that he rebuilt Inti's temple at Cuzco, later began to question his god's credentials. Philip Answorth Means, commenting on Pachacuti's discontent with Inti, wrote, quote, he pointed out how that luminary always follows a set path, the sun, performs definite tasks, and keeps certain hours, as does a laborer. In other words, if Inti is God, why doesn't he ever do anything original? The king mused again. He noted that, quote, the solar radiance can be dimmed by any passing cloud. In other words, if Inti were truly God, no mere created thing could dim his light. Suddenly, Pachacuti tumbled to the realization that he had been worshiping a mere thing, as Creator. Bravely, he advanced to the inevitable next question. If Enki is not the true God, then who is? Where could a pagan Inca, cut off from Judeo-Christian illumination outside the camp, find an answer to a question like this? The answer is quite simple. From old traditions lying dormant within his own culture, that such an event is possible was foreseen by none other than the Apostle Paul when he wrote that Theos, in the past, let all nations go their own way, yet he has not left himself without testimony, in Acts 14, 16 to 17. He hasn't left himself without testimony. Pachacuti took the testimony he himself had derived directly from creation and aligned it with his own culture's most extinct memory of Viracocha, the Lord, the omnipotent creator of all things. All that remained of earlier Incan allegiance to Viracocha was a shrine, help me Lord, called Kishuarcancha, located in the upper Vilcanota Valley. Pachacuti recalled also that his own father, Hatun Tupac, once claimed to receive counsel in a dream from Viracocha. Viracocha reminded Hatun Tupac in that dream that he was truly the creator of all things. But heathen will not live by their own knowledge. Hatun Tupac promptly renamed himself Viracocha. The concept of Viracocha, therefore, was probably of great antiquity. Worship of Enki and other gods, in this view, were only recent departures from a more pure original belief system. Metreau implies as much when he observes that Viracocha-like figures are prominent in Indian cultures from Alaska to Tierra del Fuego, whereas sun worship appears in relatively few cultures. Now, for years, when I was in college, they would say, religion began animism, polytheism, and monotheism is a recent development. But modern anthropology has blown that apart just like so many other scientisms. The earliest face in all culture, revered as supreme, creator of all things. Pachacuti apparently decided that his father had rediscovered something basic and genuine, but had simply not taken the discovery as far as it deserved to go. He resolved that he, as his father's son, would take the reality his father had touched to greater lengths. Or was it, in fact, that reality which was taking him to greater lengths? A God who created all things, Pachacuti concluded, deserves worship. And it would be inconsistent at the same time to worship part of his creation as if it were him. Pachacuti came to a brisk decision. This Enki as God nonsense had been around long enough, at least as far as he and his upper-class subjects were concerned. Pachacuti took action. He called a congress of the priests of the sun, a pagan equivalent to the Nicene Council, if you like, at beautiful Coracancha. In fact, one scholar dubs that congress the Council of Coracancha, thus ranking it among the great theological councils of history. In that council, Pachacuti presented his doubts about Enki in three sentences. One, Enki cannot be universal if, while giving light to some, he withholds it from others. Two, he cannot be perfect if he can never remain at ease resting. I think we'd buy into that. Three, nor can he be all-powerful when the smallest cloud may cover him. Pachacuti then revived his upper-class subjects' faint memory of omnipotent Viracocha by listing his awesome attributes. Dr. B.C. Brundage of the University of Oklahoma summarizes Pachacuti's description of Viracocha as follows, quote, he is ancient, remote, supreme, and uncreated, nor does he need the gross satisfaction of a consort. He manifests himself as a trinity when he wishes. Otherwise, his heavenly warriors and archangels surround his loneliness. He created all peoples by his word, as well as all huacas, spirits. He is man's fortunus, ordaining his years and nourishing him. He is indeed the very principle of life, for he warms the folk through his created sun, Punchao, the sun disk, which was somehow distinct from Inti. He is a bringer of peace and an orderer. He is in his own being blessed and has pity on men's wretchedness. He alone judges and absolves them and enables them to combat their evil tendencies. Pachacuti then commanded that Inti, from that time forward, be respected as a kinsman only, a fellow created entity. Prayer was to be directed to Viracocha with the deepest awe and humility. In the aftermath of the council, Pachacuti confronts the gang. Composed reverent hymns to Viracocha, hymns which eventually found their way into De La Molina's collection. Some priests, the gang, some priests of the sun reacted with bitter hostility. Footnotes to the scholarship proof of this. Pachacuti's statements hit their vested interests like a bombshell. Others found Pachacuti's logic irresistible and agreed to give allegiance to Viracocha. Of these, many were troubled, however, by one very practical problem. How would the masses react when priests of the sun announced everything our priesthood has taught these past few centuries has been wrong? Inti is not God after all. These immense temples you built for him with awesome toil and by our command are vain. All rituals and prayers connected with Inti are futile. Now we must begin again at ground zero with the true God, Viracocha. Might not such an announcement arouse cynicism or even trigger social upheaval? Pachacuti bowed. You see, we need grace. We need grace, unmerited favor. We need a way that doesn't require perfection. The reality is, whatever our standard, and here's but proof that God is at least whispering to a heathen, as the camp meeting adherents would say, but we can't live by the standard, whatever it is. That's what God's been trying to prove. Since Adam lied to Adam, since the Satan lied to Adam and Eve in the garden and convinced them that that tree, if they ate of it, that gave them knowledge of good and evil, would make them like God. And from that day until now, God, as Paul so accurately says, the law is but a schoolmaster to teach us we can't do it. Whatever your standard, you're going to fall short. Whether you're in the camp and preening yourself and reducing God to your size and your denomination and your methods of worship and your one-upmanship posturing, or whether you're a heathen out there that sees someone by the wayside and stops and helps them, whether you our Viracocha, King Pachacuti, when confronted with living what he knew to be true, Pachacuti bowed to political expediency. He ordained that the worship of Viracocha be confined to the ruling caste, for it was too subtle and sublime for ordinary folk. And why did the Inca Empire topple within a mere century of its zenith under King Pachacuti? Nobody knows. But the common people were kept from the knowledge as Pachacuti compromised. There's even more staggering proofs of God's presence among the heathen, one of which I want to take you to among the Santal. 1867, a bearded Norwegian missionary named Lars rude, however it's pronounced, and his Danish colleague, a layman named Hans Borensen, found 2.5 million people called Santal living in a region north of Calcutta, India. Scrooge soon proved himself an amazing linguist. He quickly became so fluent in Santal that people came from miles around just to hear a foreigner speak their language so well. To his utter amazement, the Santal were electrified almost at once with the gospel message. At length he heard Santal sages, including one named Kolian, exclaim, "What this stranger is saying must mean that Thakur Jew has not forgotten us after all this time." The missionary caught his breath in astonishment. Thakur was a Santal word meaning genuine, and Jew meant God, the genuine God. Clearly he was not introducing a new concept, but talking about one supreme God. The sages brushed aside the terminology he had been using for God and insisted that he was talking about Thakur Jew. "How'd you know about Thakur Jew?" the missionary asked. "I'll tell you next Sunday." But I'm telling you, the message, whatever your source, and God has planted eternity in the hearts of all, so don't start trying to get fair with God. Paul won't even say with absolute negative certainty, they don't have a law. He's just saying they outperform the camp meeting shouters. And he's going to prove how and show that with their own standard, they too, as all of us, fall short without hope. Except he reached in grace when our mind finally is taught by the law that we are all without hope. No more conspire in the garden to tell us we can do it ourselves. Without hope, he came to redeem and now gives us a path that only requires that we trust him from faith to faith. That's been the message, will still be the message of this church, and that's my message today. Offering time. Offering time, and I hope that you will be faithful in your commitments. You may be seated. Be faithful in your commitments this week. We're seeing amazing, amazing figures on the Nielsen scale of the Sunday night hours on Channel 56. No other religious program in the whole city gets even a they don't even make a 1 or 2. And we're 5. That means I need you there as voices of faith. This afternoon, tonight, and all through the week. Make your reservations today. Will you? Don't give me that agony of waiting until Wednesday to see if you're there. And Secret 15, the weeks are passing on. You got to do something like the widow that gave of her lack, and then God supplied. Don't wait for God to supply and then give. Give and wait for God to honor his word. Secret 15 is going to happen. It's going to pass you by, some of you. Or you're going to seize it in faith. It's an opportunity to move from faith to faith. Good day, folks. The song is You Gotta Have Faith.